Hello and welcome to Sound Body, a weekly program of information on health topics and ideas that can help you live life to its fullest. I'm Louise Craig. Last week, we began the article, The Smartphone Psychiatrist, which introduced us to Tom Insel and brought us up to date on his career as a psychiatrist firmly planted in the camp of neurobiology. After spending more than a decade as the director of the National Institute of Mental Health, he lamented the discrepancy between advances in medical health and mental health. While mortality rates for just about every physical illness had gone down, the rates of suicide and disability due to mental health conditions had not. An analogy that was mentioned in the first half of the article alluded to in the second half of our reading. So in this analogy, he talks about being told that psychiatry was focusing on just the chemistry of the paint in a house, instead of realizing that the whole house is on fire, as well as telling his colleagues that they were not making any meaningful progress, he roiled the psychiatric establishment by ditching use of the DSM-5 manual at the NIMH. The first half of the article also talks about his research on voles that led to an understanding of the role of oxytocin in bonding behavior, which was the first time that neurochemistry was definitively shown to alter behavior. This finding ushered in an era of looking for clues in biology rather than environment to solve mental health problems. In the second half of the article, we follow his progress as he moves from academia to Silicon Valley in the search for ways to use smartphones to reduce the world's mental anguish. The Smartphone Psychiatrist was written by David Dobbs and published in the July-August 2017 The Atlantic. Almost all medical research faces the same challenge, striking the right balance between basic research, how does this work, and translational research that converts the basic findings into treatments. How can we make this work differently? To many critics, the NIMH had that balance wrong, focusing too heavily on basic neuroscience research. Another criticism leveled by Francis and others is that defining mental disorders as brain disorders underplays what psychiatrists call the psychosocial nature of mental states and mental health, the countless dynamics in social relationships that affect our psyches. A reductive biological model arguably neglects, for instance, the growing evidence that social isolation aggravates mental illness, while social support ameliorates it. Trying to understand mental illness without accounting for the power of social connection, this line of thinking goes, is like studying planetary motion without accounting for gravity. Likewise, defining mental illness as a brain disorder shortchanges the role played by environment in general. Mental illness often occurs when a vulnerable psyche faces stress, sometimes chronic, sometimes sudden and acute. Many brain and large-scale genomic studies ignore this because the researchers don't think environment is important or because it's hard to parse environmental effects into measurable components. Either way, a key element of mental health and illness can go overlooked. Insel and his defenders say he did his best to respond to these problems. They note that he pushed NIMH research to yield more help faster for the sickest patients, and that he funded plenty of research on environment, behavior-based therapy, and social connection. E. Fuller Torrey is a psychiatrist who worked at the NIMH in the 1970s and then became one of its fiercest critics as its emphasis increasingly focused on basic neurobiology in the 1990s. He was not thrilled about Insel's appointment. "He'd worked on voles," Torrey says. "My expectations were low." Torrey, among those who called loudest for the NIMH to generate not just findings but treatments, had developed a metric to tally what percentage of NIMH studies stood a reasonable chance of helping patients. When Insel took over, Torrey told me, that estimate stood at about 5%. Insull brought it up into the 20s. He did a yeoman's job. I have nothing bad to say about Tom, except that he didn't stay longer. Insull never wavered from framing the Institute's mission as biological. When I asked him about this directly, he unambiguously defended the NIMH's biocentric stance. But if you examine the later years of his tenure closely enough, you see signs of vacillation, of someone still believing something, but without as much conviction. This comes across in his 2013 TED Talk. Insull, as at ease, confident and disarming as ever, opens with his iconic graphs showing how psychiatry has gone nowhere for decades. Then, after telling the audience members that he can understand why they think he should be fired, he pivots to say, "I think we are about to be in a very different world as we think about these illnesses," and describes the newest wonders the NIMH is discovering about the brain. I keep going back to that talk because right there on the TED stage, Insull seems to be of two minds. When he embraces his dismay and then sets it aside, I feel I'm seeing a person who is in the process of flipping his allegiance between two contradictory ideas. By the time of his TED talk, Insull had ceased believing, not just in the categories used to describe mental illnesses, but in the magic of drugs or genomics to diagnose and treat them. He was essentially saying of psychiatry, "We've fallen short of our promises for decades, but we're finally figuring out the brain, so we'll deliver." Yet even as he described the brain's wonders, Insull seemed to understand that he was still talking paint chemistry and not attending enough to the raging fire. "Tom was very blunt toward the end of his tenure," says Bruce Cuthbert, who worked alongside Insull at the NIMH and served for 10 months as the acting director after Insull left. "He was brave enough to say, actually, we don't know much of anything at all that could help individual patients." Insull is impatient. When he'd been at the NIMH, he told me recently he'd thought of the results horizon as being 10 to 30 years out, but he is 65 and tired of waiting. "I want to make something happen in 3 years," he told me this as we sat in the enormous, airy lobby of the new Verily building in South San Francisco. Early this May, as I was putting the final touches on this story, I emailed Insull to confirm and update a few things, and found that he was leaving Verily the next day. As small and nimble as Verily was compared with the NIMH, he said, he was now joining a far smaller outfit called Mind Strong Health, a startup co-founded by three people, himself, Paul Dagham, and Richard Klausner, that would pursue an agenda much like the one he'd outlined at Verily. A similar path, he told me. Insull had jumped the track again. 2 weeks later, I visited him at home in Pleasanton, California. "I loved working at Verily," he told me. It was only after he started there, he said, that he grasped the scale of ambition and possibility that today's biotech landscape offered. He liked Verily's CEO, Andy Conrad, whose brash, sometimes profane style has reportedly driven away some other top Verily employees. "It was hard to leave," Insull said. "But the features inevitable in a 500-person company, Verily, that was part of a 74,000-person company, Alphabet, Google's holding company, made a smaller option look much better." "The speed bumps you have to go over to get something out the door," Insull said, "would now be fewer and lower." As we talked, Mind Strong was remodeling offices in Palo Alto, an hour's drive away. Insull said he plans to work most days from home, where he can have lunch with his wife and where a garden, a pool, a chicken coop, and a 300-vine vineyard beckon out back. But Insull didn't join Mind Strong for the barefoot commute. He likes his co-founders and the greater agility offered by what he calls a two-pizza company, small enough to feed with two pizzas. Currently, Mind Strong has about a dozen employees. Talking to me on his second day as MindStrong's president, Insull told me he had already found it easier to strike research partnerships with caregiver or insurer networks to test and refine the patient monitoring systems that are at the core of the company's plan. We actually did one of those last week, he said, and the network will start collecting the data this week. We can just move much faster at this size. Mindstrong's plan, much like that of Insull's unit at Verily, is to use the smartphone's powers to do two things that psychiatry hasn't figured out how to do. Easily detect early, or even predict, the onset of mental illness, and quickly get effective, affordable care to those who need it. This idea has been floating around Silicon Valley and mental health circles for several years. Insull estimates that a good 5 or 10 other companies or research teams, including Verily, are trying to do something similar. Mindstrong hopes to gain an edge by combining Insull's expertise and connections in the mental health field with Klausner's business experience and Dagham's data analysis tools and skills, and by moving quickly. The force they hope to harness is the power of daily behavior, trackable through smartphone use, to reflect one's mental health. As people start to slide into depression, for instance, they may do several of the following things easily sensed by a phone's microphones, accelerometers, GPS units, and keyboards. They may talk with fewer people. And when they talk, they may speak more slowly, say less, and use clumsier sentences and a smaller vocabulary. They may return fewer calls, texts, emails, Twitter direct messages, and Facebook messages. They may pick up the phone more slowly, if they pick it up at all, and they may spend more time at home and go fewer places. They may sleep differently. Someone slipping toward a psychotic state might show similar signs, as well as particular changes in syntax, speech rhythm, and movement. Insull says such data provide a more objective, textured picture of people's lives, one collected continuously rather than just at weekly sessions. A therapist, the joke goes, knows in great detail how a patient is doing every Thursday at 3 o'clock. With inputs like these, a phone could sense the beginning of a crisis and trigger an appropriate response. Because this response would come earlier, it could be more measured, less jarring, and less medication heavy. The earlier you intervene, the better the outcomes, Insull says. Instead of detect and treat, it's predict and preempt. Mindstrong has 3 patents for a data collection and analysis system built roughly for such purposes. Dagham designed this system, which can harvest some of the smartphone's scores of data streams. How might Mindstrong's system actually work in practice? Insull points to 2 prototype examples. The first is a company called 7Cups, which Insull first learned about because his daughter works there. 7Cups provides text-based peer counseling and support for people with depression or anxiety or a long list of other conditions. Registering for the simpler services, such as Peer Connection, takes only seconds, and users can also get referrals to either coaches or licensed mental health counselors and psychologists. According to the CEO, Glenn Moriarty, 7Cups serves a young, diverse demographic, 90% are under the age of 35, that is likely to go underserved by traditional mental health care. When Insull first heard about these demographics, he said a light bulb went off. This is about providing access for the first time, and to people who don't necessarily want to talk to a psychotherapist. They want to help each other. With a simple smartphone app and website, 7Cups seeks to quickly and inexpensively connect such people while also providing a range of clinical support. The company collects an astounding amount of anonymized data, a key to increasing its accuracy in detecting mental states and to the efficacy of its response to signs of worsening illness. When 7Cups told Insull that it gives everyone who registers the chance to take a standardized screening test for depression, anxiety, and stress, called DAS-21, he asked how long it would take to get him, say, 1,000 of those scrubbed of identifying information. They said, "We'll do 2,000 this afternoon. You want all of them, or what part?" A second rough model for Mindstrong's approach is an app called Prime, developed by Danielle Schlosser, a clinical psychologist whom Insull recruited to Verily from the psychiatry department at UC San Francisco. Prime, personalized real-time intervention for motivation enhancement, was inspired partly by research showing that social connection and peer support can reduce the severity of depression and schizophrenia. Schlosser designed it for people ages 14 to 30 who'd been recently diagnosed with schizophrenia. It could be adapted for use by people diagnosed with or at risk for other mental disorders. The Heart of Prime is a Facebook-like mobile app that connects members to both a circle of peers, in this case, others who have had psychotic episodes, and professional clinicians who can assist as needed. Currently, about 50 people use Prime at any given time, with at least 5 clinicians logged on and available. Most members use it daily. Members tell Schlosser they gain enormously simply by seeing that other members are perfectly normal people who happen to have schizophrenia. The app has 3 real functions. One is connecting people so they can turn to one another for help, perspective, and affirmation. Another is providing a set of motivational essays, talks, and interactive modules that help with decisions and dilemmas common among the membership. The third is quickly spotting emerging crises and responding with peer, social service, and clinician support. Sometimes it works in more dramatic fashion. Schlosser describes one participant who, because he regularly conversed with people in the group, felt free to volunteer something he might not have if he were more isolated. He confessed that he was feeling a bit off, as if he might be sliding back toward psychosis. When Schlosser's team reviewed his message history, it saw changes in syntax and language use that suggested emerging psychosis. His physician then tweaked his meds, and both his unease and his disordered syntax resolved. A system like Prime, or the one used by 7Cups, notes Insel, combines the 2 components necessary to any approach to mental health care: assessment, by collecting and analyzing the data a person and his smartphone can provide, and intervention, which might include anything from informal social support to medical support, either inpatient or outpatient. MindStrong, he says, will first focus on assessment, spending the next year or so testing phone-based data collection and analysis systems, and then explore ways to partner with others to provide intervention through what Insel calls learning-based mental health care. Continuous assessment and feedback would drive the interventions. Likewise, all therapies would use measurement-based practices, which give clinicians and patients steady feedback on what's working and what isn't, an approach shown to sharply improve outcomes. To preserve users' privacy, Insel says, MindStrong will collect information only on an opt-in basis, and all data will be strongly encrypted. For most services, MindStrong will not save actual data streams, such as what is said in spoken or typed conversations, but only metadata that reflects state of mind without revealing actual conversation. This might include semantic structures or the repeated use of keywords or phrases that can reveal emotional or cognitive states such as depression, mania, psychosis, and cognitive confusion. All data will be firewalled according to strict patient privacy practices. Even such metadata, of course, might make an attractive target for people who'd want to exploit it. Picture a digital-era version of the Nixon administration's bungled attempt to steal the psychiatric records of Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the Pentagon Papers, so that it could blackmail or smear him. The only thing stopping such an effort in digital form might be the strength of MindStrong's firewall or its willingness to defy a government request for data. This danger is real. Google, for instance, has steadily reduced the proportion of government data requests it responds to, but in the second half of 2016, the company reports, it still produced data for 60% of such requests overall and 79% of such requests from the U.S. The company reveals little to the public about which requests it honors or why. For these reasons, some digital privacy experts think it's dangerous for any company to collect and keep something as sensitive as psychiatric patient data. For his part, Alan Francis, feels it's naive to trust any commercial entity to permanently protect such data from other commercial interests, hackers, or a government bent on getting the information. Others argue that this worry is itself naive, since most of us already leave enough footprints with smartphones, computers, phone calls, and credit card purchases to forfeit the privacy Francis wants to protect. The question may not be whether a mind-strong firewall would be perfect, but whether it would be stronger than the many porous containers already holding our personal and medical information. I once asked Insel how he saw his move to Silicon Valley in relation to the rest of his career. I expected he'd say it was a complete departure. Instead, he said it felt to him like a return to his first concerns, a return to behavior. He meant the voles. The fundamental assumption behind the vole work and behind Insel's career at NIMH was that beneath behavior lay biological mechanisms you could discern and then tweak to change that behavior. The crux of the biological model, in other words, was that you could and should address mental illness from within. Otherwise, why bother with the nearly impossible job of figuring out how it all worked? You looked for mechanisms so you could fix the machine. Now, however, Insel means to address mental disorders not from the inside, but from the outside, and not with something new, but with things at hand. He's shifting from mechanistic discovery to practical application. He is acting on the epiphany he had when the man at his talk complained that Insel was discussing paint chemistry when he should have been putting out fires. It was then, Insel says, that he began to realize that the really urgent issue isn't that our treatments get better, but that we don't use what we have today. Insel will always believe in the value of research, of figuring out how things work, but our most pressing problem, he says, what keeps psychiatry from making the huge strides that have been made in disciplines like infectious disease and cardiology, is not what we don't know. We know well enough what works. Our problem is that we're not doing it. The other big development in Insel's work today is his embrace of social contact as a basic health necessity. For this, he credits Schlosser's work. She convinced me that people with psychotic illness really crave social connections, he said. This was a great wake-up call for me, to see they want to connect on their own terms, sometimes anonymously, on their own schedule in a way that they feel they can control, often with others like them, in relationships that feel equal, rather than only with clinicians who may seem to hold too much power. Why didn't he come to all this sooner? Why now? I asked. I've always believed, he said, that to get the most impact, you should go where you get the most traction. Even 5 years ago, he said, he could not have gotten traction on the ground that he and MindStrong are working today. Smartphones weren't ubiquitous enough. The data weren't rich enough. But now, he said to me, now we can do this. He was leaning forward and smiling and holding both hands up in front of him as if he were fixing to catch something, as if he were a basketball player who just shook his defender and was calling for the ball to take an open shot. His eyes had the look of someone who felt he couldn't miss. And we have time to read from a August 2017 real simple article on 7 ways to save on healthcare, and we will be able to read a few of them. And one of the ways they suggest to save on healthcare, search for perks. Many insurance companies offer members sessions with a wellness coach, financial advisor, therapist, and other experts, says Lowenthal. If you're strapped for time, consider telenutrition consults, which allow you to chat via phone or the internet. Check your plan to see if massage is covered too. Another tip: mind your meds. Shop around. Costs can vary greatly from mom-and-pop pharmacies to stores like Costco or Target, says Lowenthal. Try the GoodRx app, which is free on iOS and Android, and that is GoodRx, which shows the cheapest price for medications in your area and provides coupons from manufacturers. No need to print. See if it's possible to buy prescription medication in a 3-month supply. Research shows you can save on average 29% in out-of-pocket costs. And nix excessive exams. Request copies of your medical records when you see the doctor, then snap photos and store them on a flash drive. Or use a secure app like My Medical, which is available for $5 on iOS and Android. So they're at the ready. This way, you'll avoid taking repeat pricey tests, and the information may help other doctors treat you without having to order additional tests. Cover college kids. If going on a parent's plan isn't possible, or if a student is over 26, many colleges offer student health insurance plans, in which financial aid can help pay for basic coverage. Under the Affordable Care Act, students who don't live in the same state as their parents can fill out an individual insurance application, and the cost of both their plan and their parents may benefit from a premium tax credit. And lastly, we have share appointments. A great way to stretch your dollars? Shared medical appointments. At some clinics and family practices, you may have the option to share an appointment and could pay a fraction of the cost, says Marianne Samego, MD, Director of Shared Medical Appointments at the Cleveland Clinic. Group visits allow you to get hands-on care from doctors and share experiences with people who have similar chronic conditions, such as diabetes or asthma, or general wellness concerns like weight loss. Some shared appointments offer private, individual exams, while other exams may be done with the group, says Samego. Appointment sharing can also make treatments not covered by your insurance more affordable. And state health care plans may change. For the latest information, you should visit the nonprofit advocacy group Families USA at familiesusa.org. There we have it. We finished the article, The Smartphone Psychiatrist by David Dobbs. And if you want, you can go back to the podcast of last week's first part of the article. I thank you for tuning in to Sound Body today. Stay well. And come back next week for more healthy living ideas. This has been Sound Body, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm Louise Craig, and I hope you'll join me again next week for more health updates and information for healthy living. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, WXXI.org.